He applied himself to the UFO thing with an intensity that absolutely left us all exhausted. McDonald marked his coming out with a trip to the Air Force's three-man UFO PR front, Project Blue Book, at Wright-Patterson AFB in June 1966. Even though the most sensational sightings and UFO incidents had been siphoned off into other secret channels, McDonald was shocked by the impressive reports he found in the Blue Book files and was scandalized by the weak explanations that had invariably been assigned to them. He sought an immediate meeting with the commander of the Foreign Technology Division at the base, Brigadier General Arthur Cruikshank, who looked after Blue Book. "The Air Force is in a bad spot," he warned Cruikshank. "You're going to have a lot of difficulty getting out of it." McDonald was not intimidated by military types. He had served in the Navy as a cryptographer during the war and had worked with the Office of Naval Research for years, doing much of his academic atmospheric research under a funding grant from the ONR. Yet he was unprepared for the runaround he would get. McDonald had just walked smack bang into history's most comprehensive and prodigious concealment. Being a man of regulation issue openness, and fair-minded in his dealings with other people, McDonald was unable to envisage the cynicism that underlay the cover-up he had unwittingly collided with. He told friends and colleagues that the official neglect of the UFO phenomenon was probably not the result of a cover-up but of a grand foul-up, where the authorities had simply mishandled the situation out of ignorance and sloppiness. McDonald flew from Blue Book to the Project's official scientific consultant on astronomy, Dr. J. Allen Hynek, at Northwestern University, in Illinois. A witness to the tense meeting reported that McDonald pounded on Hynek's desk. "You've betrayed your responsibility to science, Allen. You should have spoken out years ago." The calm, bearded Hynek sucked on his ever-present pipe, then replied, "You just don't understand the situation, do you, Jim? Where were you when I tried to get support from the academic community?" McDonald visited Blue Book a few weeks later to pore through its files again. He found an embarrassing oversight, a report of a 1953 meeting that the CIA had convened, the Robertson panel, that recommended that the UFO subject should be demystified and debunked under an official media program. Over the next few years, McDonald worked hard to offset the negative effects of the Robertson panel. Managing to balance academic duties with his one-man crusade, McDonald pushed the controversial subject onto the agenda at a host of scientific gatherings, at symposia or specially convened meetings at the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, NASA, the National Astronomical Association, the American Meteorological Association, the United Nations Outer Space Affairs Committee, the Institute of Electronic and Electrical Engineers, and the American Society of Newspaper Editors. McDonald was honest but scientifically cautious about the nature of the more mystifying flying saucer reports he investigated. Of the possible explanations for them, he said that the extraterrestrial hypothesis is, at present in my mind, the least unlikely. Even couched in this circumspect way, McDonald's statement was courageous. In 1967, Time magazine said he was farther out on a saucer's edge than any other U.S. scientist. It quoted his strong assertion, "I think that UFOs are the number one problem of world science." In mid-1968, ONR cut off the research contract to McDonald that he had used as a broad umbrella to shelter his UFO research under. He battled on regardless. 1 month later, in July, he appeared before the only congressional committee meeting that the United States House of Representatives has ever convened on UFOs. The six-hour session was addressed by a number of scientists, including McDonald. This meeting of the Committee on Science and Astronautics had been put together by McDonald and Congressman J. Edward Rush, of Indiana. McDonald's frenetic activity had about it the feel of a man with limited time. He seemed to be rushing, as though he couldn't get it all done in his lifetime, a friend related. The McDonald juggernaut began butting up against the fragile outer shell of the government conspiracy. Witnesses from within the Air Force began sharing with him extraordinary flying saucer sightings. McDonnell's luggage started to go missing on his research trips around the country. When his suitcases turned up, they were invariably found to have been rifled. One day he stepped off a plane to make a phone call during a 15-minute stopover in Los Angeles. He must have had a tail on board. His briefcase disappeared from under the seat. When it was returned to his front door in Tucson by a mysterious courier at midnight, McDonald found that his papers and witness tape recordings were intact but had been sorted through. He was philosophical about these annoying antics. "I'm just getting used to it," he told a friend. "That's the way it is." After May 1969, he began noting that cars would follow him in Tucson, plain vehicles with no license plates. The normally even-minded professor began to get jumpy with staff poking around his office on innocent visits to retrieve files. The Condon Committee report in 1969 dealt McDonald a devastating professional blow, in effect implying that his UFO work was unscientific nonsense. He spent the next few years poking holes in the report's flaky contents at every opportunity. Edward Condon responded by trying to get UFOs banned from discussion at professional gatherings McDonald attended. In early 1971, shadowy figures high up in the government cover-up opened lines of communication to McDonald either as a disinformation exercise or in an attempt to pull him into the conspiracy. "I think I've got the answer," he told a fellow scientist and UFO researcher. "I found out what's behind it. You won't believe it." He told another friend that people at the top had taken him into their confidence, but in the meantime he was sworn to secrecy. "I've got to pin it down a little bit more, and then it'll come out." In March, McDonald appeared before a congressional committee as one of the scientific witnesses making a case against proposed supersonic passenger planes, SST, that he and other scientists felt would degrade the upper atmosphere and damage the ozone layer. A congressman, Representative Silvio Conti, of Massachusetts, had been primed beforehand about McDonald's flying saucer interests. He kept mocking him in front of the committee, to appreciative laughter from the assembled throng. Finally, he delivered his punchline: "A man who comes here and tells me that the SST flying in the stratosphere is going to cause thousands of skin cancers has to back up his theory that there are little men flying around the sky." In 1971, Jim McDonald slipped quietly into a depressive state. His normally tidy office became a mess. Papers that he was working on for publication stalled halfway through. Bereaving family circumstances took their toll. His biographer, Andrew Ruffell, has speculated that a disturbed domestic environment as a child in Depression-era Minnesota had failed to equip McDonald with the emotional resources to ride out hard times on the home front. A double whammy of professional and personal setbacks proved too much, even for a man of his magnitude. On 12 June 1971, James McDonald died, thus ending one of the most promising phases of public UFO science. No one with his commitment, courage, and connections ever stepped forward again to carry the UFO banner into the heart of a hostile establishment. The 51-year-old left extensive journals of his UFO research, but the small pocket notebooks that had been used to record his most confidential meetings and notes mysteriously disappeared from his files and have never been found. If history is any guide, secret history, that is, sometime in the weeks after Barack Obama's inauguration, a group of officials, and possibly private citizen appointees, will file into the Oval Office or a nearby meeting room and brief the new president on the deepest secret in the American government. They will almost certainly arrive under conditions of strict confidentiality, perhaps similar to those that were demanded for a special, top-secret White House meeting in 1953. Due to the nature of the meeting, it is necessary to take special security precautions and to maintain absolute secrecy regarding participation in, as well as the substance of, the meeting. President Eisenhower's aide Robert Cutler wrote members of the National Security Council. It is requested that you enter the White House grounds via the southeast entrance not later than 8.45 a.m. and descend from your car at the south, diplomatic, entrance of the mansion. Your car should be discharged and not wait anywhere in the vicinity of the White House. Unlike 56 years ago when a flip chart presenter was probably the only visual aid available to support the presidential briefing papers, this meeting will probably have a laptop, data projector and screen to highlight the essential points. For an idealistic new president with a much publicized commitment to transparency and open government, the briefing will almost certainly prove unnerving and distressing. Obama will be told that for over 60 years the American government has had certain knowledge of visits to Earth by aliens. He will be told that his military are in the possession of numerous crashed UFOs of advanced design. Doubtless the room will be taut with a watchful silence as the briefing officer, possibly the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, moves further into his explosive summation, that major programs of technical inquiry have been carried out into how these craft operate. For the uninitiated, the revelations will come like hammer blows from the Twilight Zone, that bodies of aliens have been retrieved and preserved, and, almost certainly, that representatives of the president's government long ago met and established contact with some of these extraterrestrial visitors. The profound cultural, technological and strategic implications of these developments will be traversed and discussed. The president will doubtless probe and provoke, his keen mind coaxing the visitors deeper into the detail of their subject. A follow-up meeting will probably be discussed and diaried. And then the White House visitors will depart their perplexed chief, leaving him with a peculiar dilemma, to follow in the footsteps of his last 11 predecessors and keep the lid on this momentous secret, or launch a risky new era of openness with all its awesome potential to change planetary life in ways that can scarcely be imagined. Of course, if he takes the bold path in favor of public disclosure, President Obama will not exactly be telling us facts we don't already know. Most of what he will have been told in sepulchral tones by his grave advisors is already in the public domain, at least in broad outline and sometimes in surprising detail, and has been so for decades. What he will be doing, of course, if he plumbs for openness, is carrying out an act of admission, a confession of seismic implications, rather than an act of revelation. It will be an act of legitimation, of liberation even. It will free up the vast organs of the world's news media, academia, science, religion and the instruments of national and international government, to explore this sensational millennial development without the poisonous atmosphere of derision and career-threatening disreputability that currently surrounds it. Which way will Obama go? The safe route, and doubtless the one that will be pressed upon him by his advisors, is to keep his trap shut, play along with this tired charade, and focus on the current economic crisis and the many pressing strategic challenges that his administration faces. He will be pressured to take this course by the selection of facts and the line of argument that his advisors on the UFO phenomenon present. They will almost certainly, and probably with good intentions, emphasize the dominance in the alien interaction with Earth of the equals greys, the short creatures with black, wrap-around eyes and spindly arms and legs whose image has penetrated just about every corner of our popular culture, from t-shirts, to pencil erasers, to fairground balloons, to B-grade movies, make that A-grade. Spielberg used the greys as the model for his aliens in Equals Close Encounters of the Third Kind. The ubiquitous greys have clearly been the culprits in the abduction phenomenon that has been extensively described by numerous investigators since the 1960s. Their craft appear to have been the main ones that have crashed over the years. And, not least, they have been implicated in some of the more disturbing, even chilling, phenomena that have surrounded a small proportion of UFO activity. Their intentions, on a balanced judgment, are difficult to describe as either benign or malign, rather as neutral or even indifferent, exploitive but not, as a rule, hostile. Their wide activity ties and the diplomatic tightrope that the U.S. administration walks to keep their interaction within militarily and politically tolerable bounds, appear to be the raw nerve that drives the whole government suppression apparatus. But it would be a mistake, in my opinion, for Obama to base a policy response on the activities of the Greys alone and the benefits to public order of equals looking the other way. A number of other, more encouraging, alien contacts have occurred throughout the world over the last 60 years or so, and the more authentic and credible of these equals contactee cases give us much more cause for optimism. Instead of the relatively uncommunicative style and impersonal scientific orientation of the Greys, these contacts, often with visitors who look exactly like us, promise a more balanced and inspirational level of cultural contact and exchange. These aliens hold out the promise of the momentous and enriching epiphany that mankind's wildest dreams of extraterrestrial contact have long conjured up. These fascinating and wildly varying contact events are, in their sweep and totality, a powerful counterweight to the disappointing and perplexing Greys. They portend a diplomacy of great complexity and novelty, but they also hold out the prospect of fruitful enlightenment for a lonely planet reeling with problems of ecology, poverty, economics and governance. These are the visitors we have been waiting for. How it all started, the Roswell UFO crash of 1947, is credited in the popular imagination with having been the first of the equals crash/retrieval incidents of the modern era. It has given rise to a TV series, a movie and numerous books. More military veterans have spoken out about their role in the retrieval of wreckage and bodies from this site than for any other crash that whistleblowers have revealed. Certainly it is a seminal event in the UFO timeline, not least for having been the first crash to be reported contemporaneously by newspapers, if quickly covered up, and has given rise over the years to an unprecedented stream of leaked documents of huge historical interest. We will return to Roswell shortly to draw insights from the more credible of these archival papers, but the honor of being the first place to host a piece of malfunctioning extraterrestrial hardware may lie with another continent, with Europe, where there are interesting reports of a UFO having crashed in 1937 in the western part of modern-day Poland, then eastern Germany, near the village of Jasnica. A multicolored ball was seen to fall in a field and was soon surrounded by SS troops from the nearby garrison of Jelenia Góra, then called Hirschberg. The object was transported to Jelenia Góra, where it was reportedly kept under strict guard. A year later, a top-secret meeting with scientists was reportedly convened there. In a preview of a later pattern that would emerge in America, leading figures from the mushrooming new science of nuclear physics were in attendance: Max von Ley, Otto Hahn and Werner Heisenberg. In 1943, the Jasnica UFO was delivered to an underground factory complex constructed by the Nazis for war production in the nearby Gorisoe Mountains, and there the trail peters out. The first modern-day UFO crash in the United States appears to have occurred near the town of Cape Girardeau, Missouri, in 1941, again a crash in the countryside, but this time with more detail, a description of pieces of metallic debris of advanced design, and three bodies of creatures similar to the Greys. The report emanated from a minister of religion who was called to the site by local police, who initially thought that an aircraft had crashed. The Reverend William Huffman got a good look at the three creatures as he said a prayer over their bodies, which showed no sign of injury. He was sworn to secrecy by military personnel who were in attendance, but confided all the details to his wife and children. A granddaughter gave a detailed report to researchers many years later in 1991. There is tentative confirmation of this event: a leaked, authentic-looking UFO-related document from military archives refers to a crash incident on mainland USA from which equals artifacts were recovered in 1941. The detailed events of the Roswell crash of July 1947 do not bear repeating. Any number of books and articles can be consulted which provide information on this event and its aftermath, much of it outlined by former military witnesses who were brave enough to go equals on the record in their old age when the threat of official reprisal had lost its potency. What is worth examining about Roswell is not so much what was found, debris of advanced technology and great-type creatures again, one or two of which were still alive, but the apparent extent of the official investigation which followed, and the historically important people who were involved. Investigators from the Army Counterintelligence Corps IPU unit who were involved in the two-day scene examination reported later that they had recognized a number of scientists present from the General Advisory Committee of the Atomic Energy Commission, most notably J. Robert Oppenheimer, the equals father of America's atomic bomb. A number of Operation Paperclip scientists were also seen. German rocketry specialists repatriated to the United States after the Second World War to work on the American space and missile programs. Paperclip scientists present included Wernher von Braun, who had been a leader in the German missile program, Ernst Steinhoff and space medicine pioneer, Dr. Hubertus Strufhold. An initial report to the head of the Army Air Force, General Nathan Twining, a few weeks after the crash mentions participation in the deliberations by personnel from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, California Institute of Technology and various branches of the military. Oppenheimer, von Braun and Steinhoff were mentioned, as was Theodor von Karman, a Jewish-Hungarian aerodynamicist and consultant to the Air Force. A fuller report of authentic-looking appearance and content, seemingly for presidential consideration, is also in the public domain from this time. It was leaked in 1996 with many deletions in black felt tip pen. Much of the document is illegible through equals carbon copy fading. The report authors had been tasked with a wider brief from the Roswell crash, including political and national security considerations. The mission members were mainly an array of military top brass, including Major General Leslie Groves, military controller of the Manhattan Project during the war, and three administration civil employees: James S. Dudley, assistant executive seconds retreat to the recently constituted National Security Council; Thomas J. Lynch, a Department of Justice lawyer and engineer; and Carlisle Humeldine, who had worked at the Pentagon for Chief of Staff George C. Marshall during the war and followed him to the State Department in 1947. Among the equals contributing members to the mission were Oppenheimer, von Karman and equals Professor Albert Einstein. This report refers to equals the recovery case of 1941 and regretted that no equals unified intelligence effort to exploit possible technological gains had resulted from that earlier recovery equals, with the exception of the Manhattan Project. The committee seems determined to exploit the captured technology from Roswell in whatever way it can, and refers to the possibility of studies on recovered microcircuitry underway at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, being fed into the equals proposed hydrogen bomb program. Under the heading equals political considerations, the report reached conclusions that would clearly shape American policy for the next 60 years. That public disclosure would be damaging to political and social order, and bring into question the credibility of national security arrangements, scientific knowledge, and public trust in institutions and religious structures. It recommended that a policy of equals plausible denial be adopted to explain away UFO phenomena. Hundreds of people had clearly been involved in the post-crash investigations. In addition to various military agencies mentioned as participating in crash debris analysis, the report mentioned other organizations crossing over into the civilian realm who were studying equals recovered exhibits. The EEC, Atomic Energy Commission, NEPA, the Nuclear Energy for the Propulsion of Aircraft Project, NECA, the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, the predecessor of NASA, the JRDB, Joint Research and Development Board, the RAND Corporation and MIT. The apparent wide dispersal of this top-secret material provides an interesting insight into the trusted system of security clearance operating in the U.S. military and civil administration, as well as within outside contracting agencies. This report is notable for confirming what many documents leaked over the years have revealed, and many insiders assert was the case, that the initial intelligence agency set up to oversee secret UFO-related affairs was called Majestic, or MJ-12, and that access to its affairs was limited to people with a security clearance level called MAGIC. The document ends with a paragraph memorable for its refreshing directness, possibly written by Humeldine, who had been coached over the years by Marshall to write clearly and without the use of official jargon, equals in conclusion, for reasons of national security and the public well-being, the U.S. must be perceived as being the top of the heap, and every effort must be made to ensure that there is not, and never has been, a threat to the country. The Aztec Recovery. There are nearly 100 national monuments on the American mainland, but you won't find Heart Canyon, near the town of Aztec, New Mexico, on the list. Over the years, U.S. presidents have decreed the protection of old military forts, geological landmarks, and Native Indian historical sites. There is an 8.5-mile footpath in Minnesota on the list, an old flint quarry in Texas, and a Nebraska homestead that once belonged to one equals Daniel Freeman. But in this era of surreal historical avoidance and inverted reality, it took a grassroots initiative, rather than an act of presidential power, to commemorate what took place in 1948 on a small, dusty plateau, or mesa, that lies just above the dirt road that winds through Heart Canyon. One day in 1999, a group of Aztec citizens took the law into their own hands and erected a metal plaque on the plateau to explain the mesa's historic significance. The plaque, set on the dry, yellow dirt amidst a scattering of sagebrush and cedar pines, did not refer, as it could have done, to the fact that the Canyon Road was the old stagecoach route from Aztec to the Wild West town of Durango, across the state line in nearby Colorado. Instead, its inscription was far more arresting. Recovery at Heart Canyon. The plaque headlines. On or about this site on March 25, 1948, a spacecraft of origins unknown crash-landed on this mesa. The 767 ANW radar base at nearby El Vado, an M, tracked the apparent landing to this site. A high-secrecy recovery operation took approximately 2 weeks, with all the remains being taken to Los Alamos, an M, for scientific study and evaluation by some of the world's leading scientists. The recovery of this craft by the U.S. government and military was one of the most secretive recoveries of spacecraft with origins unknown since the similar recovery in Roswell, an M, 8 months earlier. Sadly, the occupants, as many as 16, died as the result of this crash, making full disclosure of both purpose and origination all but impossible. The local townsfolk seem to have got the story pretty straight, judging from details leaked by military and scientific personnel and by a few local citizens who were the first to the scene. During the recovery operation, the federal government carved off the plateau from the local rancher and took ownership. Today the land is under the control of the U.S. Bureau of Land Management, an otherwise inexplicable island of public property in the midst of private ranches. A barbed wire fence was strung around the plateau after the cleanup operation, and this is now rusting and decrepit. It offers no barrier to UFO enthusiasts who are visiting the site in increasing numbers these days. Therein lies the uniqueness of the Aztec site. It is clearly marked and relatively easy to find, unlike the sites of the Roswell recoveries. It is truly one of the most important national, indeed international, monuments of the 20th century, or any century. Visitors park their cars and walk up the dirt track that was bulldozed by the military to get their trucks to the crash site. Journalist and author Frank Scully, who wrote a wry and witty account of UFO secrecy, government shenanigans, and the Aztec crash in his bestseller, Behind the Flying Saucers, in 1950, said that the 100-foot diameter craft had been too large to transport in one piece. The insiders who leaked the story to Scully said that the craft was virtually intact, and it took a lot of investigation to detect that it had been made, and could be dismantled, in segments. Scully's story was light on geographical details, so Heart Canyon lay largely unvisited for decades, after those who had been involved in the discovery and recovery were sworn, or frightened, into silence. One gutsy recovery worker confided the location to a friend who camped out on the plateau for several days in 1952, digging up telltale souvenirs from this remarkable episode: old canteens, web belts, K-ration cans, and the like. In 1975, another mystery man stepped off the Greyhound bus in Aztec and cabs the use of a four-wheel drive Toyota from local residents. They accompanied him as he drove unerringly to the crash site 12 miles away in Hart Canyon. He told his startled companions that this was where a UFO had crashed in 1948. The man wandered around the plateau for an hour taking photographs, and the next day left Aztec by bus again. One of the curious locals who had accompanied the photographer never forgot the location and was able to guide investigator William Steenman to the site in 1982.